morning, and welcome to the Cave Escape Podcast. I'm Caleb Groves.
And I'm Ashton Goolsby.
And it is currently 7:24 in the morning.
We usually pick a night to record, but all of our nights are busy, so we get up early on our weekend.
Yes. And I just kind of like almost unintentionally started the podcast with good morning.
So we're...
But yeah.
We're mostly awake.
Yeah, no, we're all the way awake. We're going to talk about Beowulf today. And Ashton is our Anglophile guy who just got a old English grammar off the internet that he's been studying and translating old English and stuff. So he's super excited about this one, and he has a lot to say about it.
I've been trying to do this one for a while. So I also teach it at the school that I'm working at, and I teach it to fourth graders. So it's not super in-depth, but it's one that I like, especially because I like Tolkien, and apparently Tolkien was obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have his translation of it as well. But yeah, I don't know. It's just a fun story, and I was like, we should talk about it at some point.
So mostly, this is going to be me asking him questions about it, because I actually haven't heard a lot of your thoughts about it. I've just kind of heard you be excited about it, I think. So I'm actually interested to hear all the things that you want to say about it. But I guess we should probably go ahead and talk about overview of what the story is, right?
Oh, yeah.
And maybe not assume that people have read it this time.
Yeah, we can do that. And if you haven't read it yet, well, I'm sorry for the spoilers, but you've had 1,000 years to read it, so it's kind of on you.
Right, exactly.
So it's essentially this, it's an epic poem, which the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid fall in this category as well. So it's this tradition of telling a story, but in a, like it's a long poem or song. So it's meant to be recited. So originally with epic poems, they weren't written down. So like the Iliad and the Odyssey were, they were like, you would have these bards that would travel around like Homer, and they would store them in their brains. And so they would go around and they would just speak them to people. And of course, over time, if you've ever tried to remember the same story and tell it, you don't end up telling it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So over time it actually changes. So we're pretty sure the Iliad and the Odyssey, we have a version of it written down. And that's the version that we translate from, because at some point somebody said, hey, this is important enough to write it down. But there's elements of it that would change over time. Like, for instance, in I think it's in the Iliad, there's a reference to this guy, Aeneas, who's in the city of Troy. And they would say, and Aeneas had this great destiny. And the destiny was king whose hall I'm currently passing the night in, his destiny was to be your great 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 grandfather and give birth to you, and you were going to grow up and be a great king. So it's a way of also, like, you could adapt it to who you were telling it to as
right.
well. So it's kind of flattering, like their guest. So some of it was just over time they changed it just because they forgot what they originally said, or sometimes they specifically chose to change it for different reasons. But another thing is it's not just prose. It's not just he's telling a story like I'm just talking to you right now. It's in a poetic style.
Mm-hmm.
And reading something like this actually helps even reading something like the Old Testament, especially the Pentateuch, because we all the time talk about scripture being written in a poetic style. And so there's a lot of debate on what does that look like? How do we understand how to read it? Things like that. But in a similar way, something like Beowulf or the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid even are written in poetry because it helps. It's beautiful to listen to, but it also helps with your memory. So there's certain things like if you ever heard, you're classically educated, you know the word chiasm?
Oh, yeah.
So a chiasm, which is like the idea of you have a point A, then a point B, then like a point C. And point C is the most important point. So after you give point A, point B, and point C, you kind of either give point B again after C, or maybe like the opposite of B. And then after B, the second B, you'll give a second A, either the same or like an opposite or something.
Yeah.
But that's a way of helping you, and you can draw it out almost like a triangle that kind of meets at C in the middle.
Right. It's kind of like a like a symmetry kind of thing. Yeah, you kind of give like an inverse shape going in on either side.
Yeah, so it's...
Can you explain? So maybe that's maybe too much, because I know that there is that in Genesis, in like the creation story, right?
Yeah.
Could you like, would that be a good example to explain what it is?
Do you know it right off?
I don't know it right off, but I was hoping you were going to know it right
off. I'm really bad at remembering examples of chiasms.
Oh.
But like you can look up on the internet. People know them all over the place in the Old Testament, the earlier books especially.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a Hebrew... The Hebrews like that poetic style, and it's good to help you pull out key points. But also, if you're living in a society where people have to remember things, it helps to put it in some type of poetic style. Because I mean, how hard is it to remember exactly word for word what somebody gets up and speaks? But then if they sing it, you can remember what they sang.
Yeah.
So it's that same idea of poetry. It has a musical element to it.
Oh, so you're saying just even spoken poetry has a musical element to it, so it's easier to remember than a song. Or no, I mean easier to remember than spoken word. Maybe not as easy as an actual song, but there's still a musical element to it, so it makes it easier to remember.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I don't know why I never thought about that.
Well, actually, this is more of a side thing, but the definition when I do poetry with my students, because I don't really have a curriculum for poetry, I just kind of compile things, but the definition that I give them, that I was given in school, is... that poetry is a language of pictures and music.
Hmm.
So it's the two main goals in poetry. You've got this picture you're trying to create in their mind. So you're using your words to create a picture. So I'm trying to think of a good poem as an example, but you're using your language to build this picture in their mind, but there's a musical element to it as well. It's got this rhythm it's supposed to meet.
Right.
A good example would be, I think this was Alfred Lord Tennyson, The Eagle, but the opening line is he clasps the crag with crooked hands. Hmm. But you could say he's got these long gnarly claws and he's sitting on a cliff. That doesn't put the picture in my head quite the same as he clasps the crag with crooked hands. I get that feeling of like the harshness in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's chosen his words specifically, but also he, according to his style, he only had so many syllables that he could fill up in this line. So he's intentionally choosing his words to fit the sound, but also this musical rhythmic quality as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Beowulf is an example of this epic type of poetry. Mm-hmm. It's not just, because like that poem I get from Alfred Lord Tennyson is only 4 lines long.
Okay.
This is obviously much longer than that, but it is actually only a fragment. So Beowulf is one of the oldest examples we have of English. So they've guessed that it's written sometime around 600 to 1000 AD.
Hmm. Whoa.
So they're not exactly sure. It's apparently an old story that was told for a long time by the pagans before Christianity came.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some slight historic placement of it. So, like, the Danes are an actual group of people. I can't remember which. Hyglac, I think, is an actual historical figure.
Oh.
We know about when he lived. So, we know the story must have obviously been after him.
Right.
And I can't remember when exactly he lived. But I think it was, like, 500-something. But then we know Christianity came to the British Isles somewhere at a little around or after 600.
Okay.
And so for several hundred years before the Norman invasion, the English were already Christianized and had churches and things. And Beowulf, we see an evidence of it was this pagan story at one time that was just told about death and vengeance and killing monsters and bravery and hoarding gold. But as they told it, I mean, it's an awesome story.
Right.
As they told it and they became Christians, you can't place emphasis on the same morals anymore,
right,
because their morals have changed.
Yeah.
So rather than placing an emphasis on, wow, look how great he is and he killed all these people and got all this money and now he's extra strong and powerful. Wow, we want to be like him because he has money and kills people. trying to work Christianity into the story more. So it's changed, most likely, possibly quite dramatically, since its original telling.
Hmm.
So it's one of those, like, the Odyssey, it was told and told and told and told, and then finally one person, or possibly two people, sat down and wrote it down.
Gotcha.
But what we have is actually, I believe the ending is missing.
Oh.
So it kind of ends abruptly, and we're missing pages at the end.
Dang, I didn't remember that.
Yeah, and there's sections. It was actually, it was rediscovered. It was in a fire, apparently, in a church. So they found it in a stack of papers, I think up under a bookcase, if I'm trying to remember what I read. They found it, but it was burned in places. So there's some spots they've had to go through and try to piece together which words were there. And there's a couple places where they kind of had to make an educated guess as to what we think was there based off of the words around it. What type of words should have filled this spot?
Right. Wow, that's crazy. But they had to do that in Old English.
Yeah. In Old English, they had to go through and go.
Yeah, wow.
We think that it would be this word. Or there was one where they didn't have the ending. So they were pretty sure it was a name, but they couldn't. They determined that it was a woman's name, I believe. This was pretty early on. Just because of the context around it, they said it needs to be a feminine name, we're guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put it in, but they're like, we're like 90% sure this is right, but there's still like a decent thought in the back of our head that maybe we're not.
Right. Yeah. Well, how about I really want to get into like more of the meat of this. Do you want to go over like overview of the story so then you can explain some of where then we can get into like the Christ imagery and stuff?
Yeah, we could do that. So the basic story is first we get this genealogy of where this guy, Hrothgar, this king of the Danes, came from. So we go all the way back we begin with Shield. And so this is another area where people have said, like, Seamus Heaney is the best one.
Mm-hmm.
I've only read Heaney and Tolkien. My most recent time through Heaney, I was like, maybe there's a better one out there. I don't know. I've heard there's from other people that there's better ones than Heaney.
Hmm.
But he's the most popular. People have said Tolkien's isn't that great. Tolkien's is a very literal translation. So he gets at a lot of like the word meanings. His appendices are really good.
So it's like the NASB of the Bible of
maybe, maybe, I guess so. but he and his trying to see here where the Heaney version is nice because it's got the Old English in it too. But there's this word, it's in Old English, it's skild scaffing. And so Heaney translates it as shield sheafson. But then people actually don't always give him the same name. And the question is, who is he?
Interesting.
It's kind of guess that he's some type of prototypical character. I don't think he's, I don't think he's real, but he seems to be a combination of like maybe different characters, but he seems to almost stand for something. Tolkien just keeps his name as Skild Scaffing. Doesn't change the names a whole lot. But we get this genealogy in which there is, you get Shield and all of his descendants. So he was a foundling as a child. And we get these stories of how he made his great kingdom. And his, I believe it was his son, was also named Beowulf. Not the Beowulf the story's about. Heaney actually translates it Beow to give the distinction. It's a different Beowulf.
Okay.
But then we get all the way down through them. We get this guy had three sons, and one of them was Hrothgar. And Hrothgar was also a great king, and he uses his wealth that he's gained from his fathers and himself, and he kind of has this time of peace, essentially. And so he builds this dining hall, this big, call it a mead hall, so they would come in and they would feast and drink mead, as the name implies. And so they're in there partying, having a good time, and enjoying all these riches and things that they've gotten. But then there's this monster in the swamp that it tells us is actually a deformed descendant of Cain from Genesis.
Yeah.
He hates hearing them in the hall partying and singing. He specifically says singing praises to God. And so then he comes up one night and just comes in and slaughters everybody that's in the hall. And then he continues to come back nightly and slaughter the people in the hall. And people go in and try to kill him, and they always die. Nobody's able to stand up and destroy this demon from the swamp that comes up at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so then these ships appear after, like, all the people have come from different places round about. And then all of a sudden these ships appear on their coast, and the guard goes down to check it out, and it's Beowulf, who's come from...
Daneland.
I think it was Geatland, actually.
Geatland. I was making that up. That was supposed to be a joke. Is Daneland a real thing?
I think the Danes were a real people. I think there's a question of who does it mean by the Danes and where did they come from?
Okay.
So Hrothgar's king of the Danes. I'm not good with names. I believe, yes, I'm looking at it here. I believe the Danes are the people Hrothgar's with. The Geats is where Beowulf is from.
Oh, I had those mixed up. Okay.
Yeah, I get them mixed up all the time.
Because I always assume it happens on England. Does it happen in England? Did you already say this?
It happens in the lands of the Danes. And like I said, there's a question of exactly where they would have lived at this time specifically. Probably, I think some people have concluded it might have been England.
Gotcha.
It's slightly unclear who some of these people are.
I just always think like Viking type people. So like Scandinavia.
Yeah. Well, I think
interesting.
I was about to gesture like I was in my classroom to the map. We gestured to the map when we read it. I'm pretty sure it's somewhere up between like Scandinavia and England, like northern France area is where they're guessing this went around. It was somewhere up in there. So anyway, Beowulf comes to help with the problem of the monster, and he disavows weapons. He says, just as the monster comes in without weapons, I'm going to fight him with my bare hands. So Grendel comes in expecting just the Grendel's the name of the monster. I guess I didn't say that. Grendel's kind of important.
Yeah.
So he comes in and is expecting to be able just to rip people apart and kill them. And he goes to grab Beowulf. He thinks in his sleep, Beowulf's not asleep, reaches up, grabs his arm, and won't let him go, and he rips Grendel's arm off, and Grendel flees back to the swamp and basically just bleeds out there and dies. And so they party and say, yay, we're free, and then they have a feast, and they have songs, and then they go to bed. Well, little did they know, Grendel wasn't alone. He
lived with his mom.
Yeah, lived with his mom, probably played video games in the basement. We'll never know that detail. So then he comes back, or say she comes back to get revenge on her son, and they've hung his arm up. They hung Grendel's arm up in the meat hall as like a trophy.
Nice.
So she comes in, kills a bunch of people, takes the arm and runs back into the swamp. So then Beowulf gets up the next day. They track the trail of blood from Grendel back to the swamp, so they know where he is.
Mm-hmm.
So Beowulf goes back. They give him this old sword. I believe it's called Hrunting, and he takes it. He jumps into the pool, swims, you know, normal amount, a couple of days, gets to the bottom, gets to the bottom of the swamp, finds Grendel's mom, fights her. He has this sword, this Hrunting that he's taken with him, and he tries to kill her with it, and it just shatters. It's this ancient sword that was supposed to be very strong. It shatters. But then, as he's looking around, he notices in this cave, he notices this ancient giant sword that only he would have been strong enough to pick up anyway. He picks it up and he kills Grendel's mom with it and sails back up swims back up to the top.
Wow!
So he holds his breath for, I can't remember how many days it is, but it's a few days.
For some reason, I always imagined that like he got to some like room under the swamp that had air.
No, the implication is that he's been holding his breath this whole time.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
So
I would never be able to do that.
Yeah, you can't hold your breath for 30 seconds.
Yes, I can. What are you talking about?
Anyway, he swims to the bottom several days, kills her, comes back up several days later. Then they have another party because they're finally safe. And Hrothgar kind of adopts Beowulf as his son. And then Beowulf gives all this treasure, and Beowulf goes home. And then we flash forward 50 years. So Beowulf has been reigning for 50 years, which actually, funnily enough, is how long Hrothgar had been reigning before Beowulf came to him.
Mm.
So then there's this guy, and Beowulf was the nephew of the king of the Geats, Hygelac. So he dies, and people wanted Beowulf to become king when he had died previously, toward the beginning of the story. And he said, "No, no, 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 no. I'm not going to be king. Give it to his son. His son is going to be king." Hmm. Well, the son becomes king, but then he eventually dies as well, and then Beowulf consents to become the king, and he reigns for 50 years.
Gotcha. So he rules both places.
No, no, he doesn't. He doesn't rule the Danes. It's like an honorary adoption kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
He's like, "I adopt you. You're my son now because you've done these great things." And he gives him all these gifts and stuff.
Oh, because you just said that and then said, now flash forward, he's been king for 50 years.
Oh, no, sorry.
So
no,
that was, okay,
gotcha. He goes back home and is king.
Gotcha. Okay, I see.
So he's reigns for 50 years. And then it tells us some random shepherd guy was out wandering through the fields and comes across a cave. And he goes down in this cave. And it's a room just full of treasure. But it's a dragon's hoard. And he goes in and he finds this jeweled cup. And he takes the cup out and he sneaks back up to the overland.
Mm.
Well, the dragon wakes up, realizes the cup is gone, and throws a fit. And comes out and starts burning the nearby village. And starts wreaking havoc on the land. Because somebody's stolen his cup.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dragon has to be dealt with. And Beowulf, I think we did the math. He was like 70-ish years old.
Wow.
Goes out and says, "I'm going to fight and kill this dragon." So he sets out. He sets out with 12 comrades. They go off. They stop, pick up a 14th guy, and they keep going. They get to the dragon. Nobody will go forward with Beowulf to fight. They all stay back. So he goes forward, the 70-something-year-old king, and he fights the dragon. He has to go 3 different times. And he does eventually have one comrade comes up and aids him. But they together, and really it was Beowulf's doing, they slay the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And then before Beowulf dies, he sends the guy back in. He says, get the treasure, some of it out, bring it to me so that I can at least see what I've died for. And so then he dies after he gets to see some of the treasure. And then the guy who came and helped him berates all the other men for being cowards for not coming to help him.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically spend this debate of, now all of our enemies are going to come in and attack and kill us because they heard Beowulf died and none of his men were willing to come fight. They're all cowards. So all of our enemies are going to come now that he's gone, and they know you're cowards. But he says, look at this treasure. He said he died to give you all of this treasure. He died so that you could have this treasure in this land and so that you could live and all this stuff. And you just abandoned him now.
Hmm.
And then that's kind of where the story ends, somewhat abruptly.
Wow!
Is it they're preparing to raise his funeral pyre as he's requested, and they said about this, and then it just kind of just stops.
Hmm.
And we just kind of assume we're it seems like we're missing pages here, because it just stops.
Gosh.
So that's the essence of the story right there.
Okay. And did you say they go up to the dragon 4 times?
3 times.
3 times.
3
okay.
times he goes up. I thought to fight that would the dragon.
Make more sense.
Okay. So he does receive a mortal wound at one point, but continues fighting. And then I can't remember. They may cut the dragon. I think they cut the dragon's head off.
Okay.
Because that would be important, Christolic imagery.
Right.
And I seem to recall that they actually do that. I'd have to go back. I didn't have time to read the whole thing again. It's been a few months since I taught it. But anyway, he kills the dragon. That in of itself is worth talking about at some point.
Right. So what are some of the Christological imagery? I mean, obviously at the end, slaying the dragon, cutting off his head, he goes up to him 3 times. That's all pretty clear. I mean, we can still definitely for sure talk about that. But I'm wondering, is there some other things that are maybe less obvious, like earlier in the story?
Well, I mean, right from the beginning, I had Haney's version open. I'm going to look at Tolkien's version. So Tolkien's is much more literal on wording.
Mm-hmm.
But it says at the beginning, it's talking about S.H.I.E.L.D. I don't see the exact line, but he was, S.H.I.E.L.D. was a foundling who grew into this great king. So you have this idea of he's great, but he wasn't great by birth. He was brought into this.
So what does foundling mean?
He was found just like an abandoned child. Okay,
gotcha.
Almost like, I think more like a Romulus and Remus type thing, where it was just like they found him kind of And they're like, where are your parents?
Yeah.
And so he was adopted and he was raised by somebody else and nurtured and shown these things. So, I mean, you've got this imagery of there's this great king who was brought into this, kind of like, I mean, that's kind of how we are. We've been brought in and made great. But then also, I mean, like, you have the, like, I mean, I would posit you also have the idea of, I mean, Christ himself was, he was born from Mary. He was not Joseph's child. Yet Joseph also kind of adopts him in mm-hmm. as well. So you have that kind of idea. I feel like maybe you could relate that more to us as like we're adopted in and
nurtured
and brought up and made great through Christ's work. But then when you get to Hrothgar and his problem with Grendel,
mm-hmm.
He's the king. He's supposed to be dealing with that, and he fails. He can't defend his own kingdom. And it's a demon from the swamp is what they call Grendel. He's spawn of Cain. It's very clear where he came from. He's a wicked evil demon. Mm-hmm. And so it's calling our mind back to Adam there even. So you've got this king who basically equates to like Adam in Genesis, who can't defend his own. He has a job. He's been built up to be great, and he's been set in the spot with authority and greatness. And he can't defend the wonderful home that he's been given to live in.
Hmm.
It falls apart. But then this other younger king shows up and comes in and defeats the demon, rips its arm off, and kills it, and it goes back to his swamp.
Hmm.
And I mean, also the idea of... So, I mean, obviously they're like... Beowulf would be like the Christ who comes and finishes the job, but then you also see Grendel doesn't die immediately. He has time to run off and then go back to his home and then die. So kind of like, I mean, Christ comes and crushes the serpent's head, but I mean, if you've ever... I don't know how often this happens. I've seen it, but like if you chop a snake's head off, it doesn't die immediately.
Right.
It keeps wriggling and writhing around. The head kind of jumps around for a second and then it goes still. So it's kind of like Christ came and crushed the serpent's head. But once you chop its head off, it's going to writhe around for a bit. And that's kind of the time we're still in now.
Yeah.
You got the serpent writhing around.
That's super interesting.
He's dying, but he hasn't completely stopped yet. So we're kind of in that period as well. So you see that he kills him, but he doesn't die immediately. He still flees back through the town and stuff.
That's cool. And so is there also like a kind of... picture of how like the old covenant was faultful, like the old covenant wasn't perfect and like couldn't like completely save you in the way the new covenant is, and the new covenant came, I forget where it, like I think in Hebrews where it's talking about like if the old covenant was faultless, there wouldn't be any reason to have a new covenant. And so there was like some, like there was human priests in the old covenant, so they weren't perfect, so they couldn't perfectly atone for our sins. So we had to keep atoning for our sins over and over and over again. But then the new covenant is a perfect one where we have a perfect high priest who actually atones for our sins once and for all and actually...
I didn't think about that.
Does away with sin and death forever.
You may see a picture of something like that with... I mean, you've got Hrothgar, and when Hrothgar's kingdom is nice before Beowulf shows up.
Right.
But then at the end, when we get Beowulf's kingdom, it's very ordered and peaceful. But because he's so strong, people are afraid to attack him, and they respect him. But also, there's this idea of Haney translated as ring givers.
Hmm.
So there's this idea of that the king is not just a ring giver. So it's what we call a kinning. So Old English puts together, and we still do this a lot in modern English too, if we stop and think about it. We'll put two words together, usually they're nouns, and we put them together to make a new thing. German does this a lot. Like Volkswagen is literally like the people's car. So that's the name of their company. People Car is Volkswagen. So Old English did the same thing. So like, so they call like the opening lines are in Old English they're "Hwat we gardena." Well, gardena is spear and Dane. So Haney puts it as the spear Danes is the name of these people. They're the Danes and they fought with spears. I had a point I was making with that. I forgot. Oh, ring giver.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea of a ring giver is a kinning. It's these two words that go together, but it means a different thing. So a ring giver is a king. So the king is somebody who gives gifts. And you see Beowulf is a good example of being a ring giver. He gives all of these things to people. So they recognize him as he's a strong leader, stronger than Hrothgar was in his kingdom. And he's benevolent. He's to be feared, but also he's very generous with what he has.
Yeah.
He loves his people. So I guess you kind of do see a Old Covenant, New Covenant shift kind of thing. Hrothgar's was good, but Beowulf's is better.
Yeah.
Another example of crystallic imagery is I was trying to remember. I feel like I won't say how. Well, I want to say it was 3 days he was spent swimming to Grendel's mom. I don't remember. The number I remember was somehow significant. But at any rate, you have this idea of when he goes to fight Grendel's mother, he has to go down into the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So just like Christ descended into hell, go read the Nicene Creed or listen to our podcast on the Nicene Creed if you don't understand that. Christ died and descended into hell to defeat Satan and then basically ransacks hell and comes back up is the traditional understanding of that.
Mm-hmm.
And these newly converted Anglo-Saxon people, by the time this was probably written down, would have been familiar with this idea.
Mm-hmm.
You have Beowulf descends, kills the demon living down there, but he also ransacks her hoard, takes his giant sword back out, and comes back up and shows it off to people. And they hail it as this massive relic from the past.
Yeah.
So you've got that idea, that imagery as well. But then, of course, the biggest one would be, I mean, at the end, you've got that the dragon.
Yeah.
Which is pretty clear.
Right.
he goes out to fight the dragon 3 different times, and he eventually he defeats the dragon. So, I mean, again, three times, 3 days, he goes out and is, you know, fighting and eventually destroys this dragon. Just like Christ for 3 days was in the grave and then rose again.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got that
imagery.
That's pretty clear. And then he goes again. He goes into the dragon's hoard and brings the gold out. But then this is one that I really try to get my students to see. Because it really is the benevolence of Beowulf is really pronounced. Like they really emphasize a king is not just somebody who sits there and tells people what to do.
Yeah.
A good king is somebody who protects his people and he's generous. He gives things out to people who merit it. So Beowulf goes and he gives his life. He dies so that this treasure that's in this mountain, he's clear about it. He says it multiple times before he dies. I've fought and died so that my people can have this treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So just like we benefit from Christ's death. Christ died for us so that we could have the treasure of everlasting life and communion with God. Beowulf dies for his people so that they can have this gold and this treasure, this buried underground that the dragon was keeping from them. So that was a pretty clear image. But
that's
the interesting thing with all of them is it's this pagan story.
Yeah.
That when the Christians heard it, they kept it, but there's certain places that the details are, it almost at times, it seems a little bit awkward that suddenly something's thrown in. So it seems a little bit, it's not completely awkward, but it seems apparent that they've added something that wasn't there originally.
Yeah.
So they've gone through the story and reworked it to make it tell about this new Christ that they've learned about.
Yeah.
So you see
them
taking their old pagan story and they're reworking it in this way that now it's Christianized. It shows benevolence and generosity and love for people instead of, I'm going to kill you and take all your stuff and then it's mine now.
Right.
And I'm going to give it to people that I like. It's protecting your people, killing evil, building nice things, preserving good things.
Yeah.
And Wow. It's just interesting to see that shift in the story.
Yeah. With our last few minutes, do you want to talk a little bit about the like how Beowulf influenced stories as a whole?
I thought you weren't going to ask that part.
Well, I would like to know a little bit. I think, I mean, if you're paying attention, then you probably already noticed some ways that it's influenced Tolkien's writings. And so we should talk about that, but I also specifically want to know how it's influenced other stuff too. Cause obviously, I mean, you said this is like Tolkien's favorite book. Mm-hmm. So of course it would have massively influenced most of what he wrote. But I'm not aware of much other influence that it has.
The main one I know is Tolkien. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien influenced right. a lot of other people to write. So I guess in that's that true. Sense also it,
yeah, that makes sense.
Was kind of big. So actually it's been regarded pretty widely since its discovery among like Anglo-Saxon or Old English scholars as a good example. It's one of the best examples of Old English that we have, especially for like poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Old English they had a runic alphabet, which is not good for writing stuff down. So they didn't write stuff down for a long time.
Gotcha.
But once monks essentially started writing things down, they adopted Latin script, which is much better at writing stuff down than runes. Yeah. So for the longest time, we didn't have good examples of their written stuff. So there's a decent amount of examples we can find, but Beowulf is a really good one. So Old English scholars were used to reading it. Tolkien was a language fanatic, and he taught Old English. Old English and Anglo-Saxon are the same thing. So if I say one or the other, they're the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But he actually, I heard a story, one of our colleagues where we teach sent me a podcast last year. It's a guy who just talks about like Tolkien, I think. But they were talking about Beowulf. They said he would start his lectures at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
They would all come into the room and they would take seats and he wouldn't be in the room yet. He would come in from the back shouting the first 50 lines of Beowulf in Old English dramatically as he gets up to the front of the room. And then he would turn around and look, and they said about half of the students would have gotten up, packed their books, and left.
What?
So they said that was his way of, I think it was Christopher, his son said, he hated grading papers. And so his idea was that weeds out the people who are serious and who aren't serious, and
oh my gosh.
That's less papers I have to grade and I can do other things.
And they're better papers.
Yeah, that too. So
that's hilarious.
So I've only gotten one source on that. I'm guessing it's true. I don't know. But either way, it's a funny idea.
And yeah.
And even to his own testament, he hated grading papers.
Right.
They would get on to him all the time for working on other things instead of grading papers.
Yeah.
And so he was doing a work on Chaucer that they confiscated from him.
You're talking about that.
They were like, you are wasting our time and money. Give us everything you have on Chaucer. Stop talking about that and go grade your papers. He's part of the reason that Beowulf has gotten more popular in recent decades.
Gotcha.
Is because he loved it so much, and he was an old English professor.
Mm-hmm.
And then people got really interested in him and found out, he really liked Beowulf. Well, let's make it more mainstream again. Some things you can see are obviously the types of characters.
Right.
It feels like it could be set in a Lord of the Rings setting.
Mm-hmm.
There's these mystical creatures and things that come in. There's monsters like Grendel coming out of the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess just a few things in the limited time we have. If you look at when he goes down to fight Grendel's mom, he goes down and he's fighting this goblin or like troll-like character. And as he's fighting, he goes into this cave. And there's these swords in this treasure cave that the monster is guarding.
I didn't catch that one.
So he goes and he pulls out this ancient sword and they come up and he hands it back to Hrothgar, the king.
Mm-hmm.
And they examine it and they go, this is an ancient sword from this time. And they give the story of the sword.
Interesting.
Much like if you've read The Hobbit.
Yeah.
They find the swords in the troll's cave and they take them to Elrond, the king of Rivendell. And he goes, this is Glamdring and this is Orcrist. And
right.
So you've got that idea of finding these ancient, lost, forgotten swords that have these magical qualities and these histories with them in this cave. Another thing that I almost forgot was the relationship of king or like father to nephew is really important.
Oh.
So if you notice, there's there's a lot of times where it's not father to son, it's father to nephew. Interesting. Father to nephew is important. Yeah. So like when Hylak dies, Beowulf becomes his chosen replacement.
Hmm.
But he also refers to him as Beowulf's sister's son.
Which,
if you're a Lord of the Rings nerd, you'll go to Rohan.
Yes.
Rohan is supposed to be a very Anglo-Saxon people. Their names for things, English people name stuff literally. They name it what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you go to England, you've got like Wessex is a region that just is West Saxony, and then Essex is East Saxony. And all the little towns a lot of times have very literal names for like what this town is and what it does.
Right.
So the same way the Shire is actually that way. Shire just means town.
Right.
And the place that the hobbits live, the town they live in, is called Hobbiton. The river is called the river. So they've got very literal names. Rohan is the same way. So like Theoden is actually the Anglo-Saxon word for king. And Thangle was also another type of Old English word for like some type of lord. But Theoden, the king of Rohan in Lord of the Rings, his heir after he dies is his nephew, Éomer. And Éomer actually is a name of a character in Beowulf. I don't remember where exactly he shows up, but Éomer is the name of a character in Beowulf.
Yeah.
So he lifted that name. But then you also have the idea of, because Theoden calls Éomer, he goes, Éomer's sister's son.
Yeah.
But there's this idea of this close-knit relationship of uncle to nephew.
Yeah, and that's Bilbo and Frodo. Too.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, you've got the uncle and the nephew thing. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That was actually where I thought you were going with it before you went, because I forgot that, for some reason, I forgot that Éomer became king after Theoden.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
But so you have those, but then going back to The Hobbit again, when Beowulf sets out on his journey, I said it. Do you remember how many people he takes with him?
Yep, he takes 13 and he picked up a 14 on the way. I didn't notice that.
He takes 13 and picks up a 14th. Much like in the Hobbit, when they set out, I got the math off. Bilbo's the 13th, isn't he? But they're not counting Gandalf.
No, right. Because they didn't want 13.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Well, at any rate, it sounds like I'm confused on the numbers, and maybe I'm wrong. I remember is I know the numbers are the same.
Mm-hmm.
They set out with 13,
yeah,
counting the leader that's with them. And when they stop along the way and they pick up a 14th guy, who's just like this random guy. But the guy they pick up is actually, I believe, the guy who originally robbed the treasure hoard.
Oh, really?
I think so, if I remember correctly. They pick up the guy who robbed the treasure hoard.
That's
so they pick up
interesting.
This burglar guy who comes with them. But do you remember what he burgled out of the Dragon's Lair? Yeah. The same thing that Bilbo goes... He just lifted it like literally out of the Beowulf story.
That's hilarious.
He has this character goes in, steals a cup, and comes back out, and the dragon has a fit.
Yep,
that's exactly what Bilbo does in The Hobbit to make Smaug mad.
Right.
So those are some examples of things that he picks up out of it.
Yeah.
Because originally the Hobbit was a story that he actually told to his kids as a bedtime story.
Right. Yeah.
And so they said there was one night that he, I think he was telling it to Christopher, that his other kids said. And so he was just telling it to him at night, just out of his brain. And they said, one night we heard Christopher go, but Dad, last night you said Thorin had on a blue cape with a silver tassel, and tonight you said it was a green cape with a gold tassel. And they said 5 seconds later, we see our dad come shuffling out of the room looking for paper. He goes, damn the boy. He's taking notes on his own story so that his son would shut up and go to sleep.
That's funny.
But yeah, so... Tolkien loved the book, so you can see a lot of things he pulled out of it. But
yeah,
it's also interesting to study as like you can still see that change from pagan to Christian going through it as well.
Yeah.
And so all of the things that we've said are reasons that I love it. I think it's a great story.
Mm-hmm. But. Yeah. And I love definitely hearing you talk about it is really awesome because you can tell that you love it. One can tell that you love it. And it just makes you like the story and be like, oh, wow, it's nice to hear people talk about stuff they love. So this was just like fun just because it was fun to hear you talk about something that you really, really loved.
And I think that does help like when I have to teach it as well, because it's for a fourth grader, especially because we read Haney's translation, which is a poetic. He's trying to get that Anglo-Saxon poetry feel.
Yeah.
So it's not very literal. It's hard for them to read.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it helps them. Like, if you can be excited about something too, I think that makes it easier on them as well.
Yeah.
To read it and understand what's going on and get in with it.
Yeah, that's probably true. But. Right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. We'll have this up on our, well, this will be attached to our blog. We'll have a blog post about it. You can reach us through email, which is Great Cave Escape, not The Great.
Nope. Just Great Cave Escape.
GreatCaveEscape@gmail.com. Please send us any questions you have, or even if you like have suggested topics. If you're like, hey, this is an interesting thing, maybe you guys should think about this or figure something out about this. Because this is, again, trying to escape the cave, trying to learn stuff.
You can
trying
also
to grow
find
our knowledge of God's creation and the universe.
You can also find us on social media as well. We have Instagram and Facebook.
Yes.
So you can message us through that as well.
That's true. I don't have social media, so don't think about messaging through that. Yes. So that's all. That's all the extra things, right?
I think that's all we have. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for listening today. And until next week, take care.